All right. It's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, my husband, Larry. And I knew him then, I knew him during, and I know him now. And I have an awesome amount of respect for where he was and where he is today, and I love him, and here you go.
Hi, everybody. My name's Larry. I'm an alcoholic. And a grateful member of Al-Anon. I took my last drink on January 2nd, 1988. I'm a little bit nervous. I didn't know how I was going to feel tonight when I was asked by Bill D. To give my story. I don't do this very often. Haven't done it for a long time. My home group is the Crested Butte Alcoholics Anonymous group. I want to acknowledge a few people in the audience tonight. The chairperson, my lovely wife. Excuse me. Well, see, she's always very helpful. Without my wife's decision to come to Al-Anon 22 years ago, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. So I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful for my buddies from Dallas who have come up here. We get to live half our time in Dallas, which is a great city, and we get to live half our time here. And we live here because we came to the conference 21 years ago and bought a second home in 1999. And Debbie and two of my youngest two children moved here in 2001. They went to high school, and we are blessed. But my buddies from Dallas are here, and a number of my friends from Crested Butte, and I'm grateful that y'all are here tonight. Thanks for coming. I'm not a circuit speaker. I'm just a garden variety drunk, trying to stay sober one day at a time. I am a recovering lawyer. And I do have a 40-page outline, 40-page outline here. So if anybody has, early babysitting issues, you might try to call them. My job tonight, as I understand it, is to tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and what's happening in our lives today. I was a functioning alcoholic. I never missed the bill. I went to work every day. There were no DWIs. I only went to jail once. But there are... Sorry, Larry. But what comes to mind are the warped lives of blameless children, failed relationships, failed business endeavors, bankruptcies, and the turmoil that alcoholism brings to a lot of us. I was born and raised in Minnesota, Minneapolis. Moved back and forth for the first 5 or 6 years I was alive between Minneapolis and Boston. I'm not sure where we lived. We lived in northern Minnesota. My biological father divorced my mother when I was 1 or 2 years old. I've never seen him, never talked to him. That has turned out to create some abandonment issues for me that I really didn't know I had until I got into recovery. Age 12, my mother remarried, and we moved to Fargo, North Dakota. And if you all saw that movie Fargo, they really do talk like that up there. I was an only child, no brothers, sisters. My grandfather died when I was 6 years old. I was raised by my grandmother and my mother. My mother worked all the time, and I had a very limited relationship with her. We were a middle-class family. We always had enough to eat, roof over our head. We didn't have much money. They're nice people. No physical abuse. I don't have any stories like that. There was alcohol in our family. My grandfather died of sclerosis of the liver, which indicates a possible problem. There was always cocktail hour. I live in a family with a lot of secrets. No one has ever told me what happened to my father and why there was a divorce. I was told to be seen and not heard, be the man of the house, be a big boy. Big boys don't cry, had all these messages. I also learned at an early age if I had enough money, I'd be okay. And these were the messages that I heard. I don't know what messages were given to me, but these were the messages that I heard when I was a kid. And at some point in time, I think I made up my mind that I was alone and by myself, and I was going to have to take care of things. And that's how I approached life for a long time. I had the same feelings that Charlotte had, being alone, being afraid. I had this feeling of, I was in the band, and I turned left, and the band went right. They all went right, and I'm always looking in from the outside. One of the things that happened when I was a kid, my mother sent me to a boys' camp in northern Minnesota, and that turned out to be the only safe place for me in my early years. Actually, I went to camp for 15 years, and I think I went to camp. I was still in law school, but but I loved it. It was a safe place for me. It was northern Minnesota. The guy who ran the camp was really the only real male role model I had as a youngster. When I moved to Fargo, I live in Minneapolis. We moved all over the place, and I never felt in a stable place. I moved to Fargo, and it was junior high school and high school years. That was a good part of my life. I have a lot of good memories. I still have a lot of good friends up there. And that was the closest thing to a normal beginning that I had. And then we moved again. And we came to Dallas. And I graduated from high school in 1961. I'm pretty old. And I wanted to stay in the Midwest and go to school. And my parents wanted me to come to Dallas and go to SMU, so I came to Dallas and went to SMU. I didn't drink in high school, didn't drink in junior high, didn't drink when I was 13 or 12. But when I was 18, that summer between high school and college, I started drinking. And my drug of choice at that time was Hamm's beer. And if any of y'all have ever had Hamm's beer, you know that you want to drink really bad. I was a real alcoholic from day one. I lost the power of choice the first time I had that sip of beer. I loved the way beer tasted. I loved the way it smelled. I loved the sound of that cap opening on that can. And I loved the way alcohol made me feel. All the fears, being alone, being scared, being uncomfortable, being different, all those feelings went away when I was drinking. Dallas, I enrolled in SMU and joined a fraternity, and that was 1961, and Woody H. is in the audience. I met Woody H. in 1961, and he taught me how to drink, really drink. And I'm forever grateful for that, Woody. I became a daily drinker from day one. one or two beers or a lot of beers during the week and on the weekends, a lot of alcohol, lots of hangovers, lots of missed classes in college, late papers, poor grades. I don't remember a lot about college either. There were good times and bad times. But my grade point in college was about the same as my blood alcohol content. Now, I graduated in 1965 from undergraduate school, barely. And I don't know if some of y'all are that old. That was during the Vietnam War, and I was not interested in going to Vietnam. So what am I going to do? Let's go to law school. So here I am with, these are, you know, this is college in 1965. It's a lot different than it is today. Here I am with barely a 2-point. I take the LSATs, I do all right on them, and I get into a couple law schools. I ended up going to SMU Law School, and they gave me a scholarship. But I like the law. I like law school. Something happened. And my drinking tapered off, and I settled down, and I studied. I did well. I graduated with some good grades. I met my first wife in law school. We got married on my the month I graduated from law school, and we were off and running. There was just one problem. It was 1968, and they still were not out of Vietnam. And they were taking anybody who could, smoke up a mirror. So I get this good a job offer, so I take a job offer. I'm a clerk for a judge. And I also have a small problem with going to, dealing with the Army and getting my draft card. So what does a good alcoholic do? I take the job. I get married. I look for a reserve unit. I find a reserve unit. And I'm not telling everybody what I'm doing because I think things are going to work out. So I take my physical, and they did work out. I failed it. So I take the job. We moved to Austin, newlyweds. I don't have many memories of alcoholic issues at that time in the first couple of years of marriage. We moved back to Dallas. I get a good job. I'm still drinking on a daily basis. I still have all the feelings I had that I described earlier. But, alcoholism grows on you. And when you get out in the real world, you've got responsibilities, you've got to deal with real world issues, and it's scary. So I found that to deal with those feelings that I didn't want to feel, that work was an answer. And I became an alcoholic and a workaholic. And during the day, I'd work. I'd go to work at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd work till 8 or 9 at night. This law firm worked with young lawyers really hard. I'd have a couple drinks, late dinner, go to bed, get up the next morning. I repeated that behavior over and over and over again for a long time. 1971, my daughter Elizabeth was born. 1974, my daughter Rebecca was born. But I was going to work, drinking, and there was really no time. I had no tools. I grew up in this home where we didn't talk, and I was kind of all by myself, so I had no tools to be either a husband or a parent. And 1978, I came home one Sunday afternoon, and I was told that we were going to separate for a little bit. So I put all my worldly belongings in my two-door Cadillac and moved into an apartment with orange shag carpeting. I remember that. Y'all remember shag carpeting? And for the next 6 months, I ate yogurt and drank beer and tried to get back in the house. And it didn't work. I lost 65 pounds. And we spent the next, my first wife and I spent the next 2 or 3 years trying to work things out, and it didn't work. And during that period of time, there was a lot of drinking on my part. Because going through a divorce and getting a separation, and I failed to mention that when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, Ozzie and Harriet was on TV, and that was my view of what a family ought to be like, and that's, I wanted an Ozzie and Harriet existence, so that's what I tried to replicate in my first marriage, and I just wasn't a good husband, and it didn't work out. I finally separated for the final time in 1980, and we got a divorce in 1981. And it was a very difficult time for me. Again, the warped lives of blameless children. So, now during that period of time, during the 70s, I was a successful lawyer, and I made a lot of money. One of the things that I had concluded would make me feel okay was if I had things. And so I spent most of my money on getting things that would make me feel good. Cars, houses, none of it ever worked, but that was my goal and job. And in 1980, going through the divorce, the relationship with my first wife over, I met Debbie. And 1981, their relationship started, and, you know, what does an alcoholic do who had just left a failed relationship because he had no tools to be a husband or a father? What does he do? He gets married again. So here we are, madly in love. We got married in 1982. And the early 80s for me were fabulous. My law business was great. You know, money in Dallas, money just flowed on trees. It just gave it away. I got into deals. The banks gave away money. I don't know if y'all read Bonfire of the Vanities, but Sherman McCoy. I was Sherman McCoy. I was master of the universe. And we lived life in the fast lane. We picked up skiing. We went to Aspen. It was 30 days a year in Aspen. We were having a good time. And I was continuing to drink on a daily basis. I was continuing to work the same behaviors that I had described earlier. I was doing it again. Our 1984, my daughter Alex was born. 1985, my son Michael was born. So here I am. I now have, deep in my second marriage, 4 children, no tools to be a father, and no tools to be a husband. We continued to lope along, and in 1987, I got involved in this big deal you know, this Master of the Universe deal for a client. And I spent about half my time in Chicago and half my time in New York. And no time in Dallas except on the weekends. And I had to play golf on the weekends. And Debbie made a decision, I believe. And if next year, I think, is her turn. So if I make any mistakes tonight, she'll clarify those next year. So Debbie joins Al-Anon, and she says, she tells me, but I don't know what Al-Anon is, so, you know, I joined Al-Anon. Okay. This deal gets over in October, middle of October in 1987, and I come home, and you know, life's not going very well. We're not getting along very well. And the babies are 2 and 3, or 1 and 2, I can't remember. New Year's Eve, 1987, I go out to the golf club and have a couple pops, and a little bit shaky, but we're having 40 or 50 people over for dinner, so I come home, get ready for dinner, have a couple more glasses of wine. People come, about 9 o'clock, we're having dinner, and right before my head hits the plate, I decide to go to bed. So I go to bed, they continue to party, and I woke up the next morning and everybody was really quiet. And of course, two of my buddies and I, we get 3 12 packs and we go down and watch the Cotton Bowl parade, right? What are you going to do? The next day, January 2nd, 1988, I'm out at the golf course and I'm not drinking too much because I still, I have a class 5 hangover from New Year's Eve. I walk into the living room and there's, we were talking about this at lunch, and we think there are 8 or 10 people in my living room. And they all have these, they're all looking like this. They all have scripts. And they all tell me that alcohol is not, my alcoholism is not working in their lives. And I'm going, what? And there was a guy named Bedford Wynn, and I know some of you know Bedford, or knew Bedford. Bedford died several years ago. And I knew Bedford when he was drinking. And Bedford's got a big smile on his face, and he's happy as a clam. And I'm looking at him, and I say, nobody is that happy. And Bedford's got me a plane ticket to go to the Meadows. And my choice that night is move out of the house, or take the plane ticket and go to the Meadows and go to treatment for 30 days. And so my law partner's there, and I take my law partner to our den, and I say, what do I do, Don? And he says, I don't know, Larry, but get me the hell out of here. So what do? I get in the car and leave and pack my bag, and I don't take the plane ticket. I go directly to Bookstop. I buy a bunch of books on alcoholism. I'm a lawyer. I start figuring out how I'm going to get back in the house because I'm out of the house at this point in time. I call Debbie. Debbie, can I come back? She has a script. No, Larry, I got to hang up. I forgot to tell you that I took the big car, and there were a lot of ice storms going around, and so we still have a resentment about that at our house. So I move into the Melrose Hotel in Dallas, and I spend a week, and how am I going to get back in the house? And, AA, I don't know what AA is. Those books I bought at Bookstop, I found myself in the books. I didn't buy the big book, of course. But I saw the physical aspect of the disease. And on January 2nd, 1988, God removed my obsession to drink. I mean, I was a daily drinker for 27 years, and I haven't had a drink since. I have no idea how I stayed sober. We saw a friend who was in the recovery business, and she told us about this deal out at the Meadows that where you go a week. And if I went a week, I'd get back in the house. I have no idea what they do out at the Meadows, but I'm going. So we go out to the Meadows, and I learn about abandonment. And I may choke up here. I learn about what effect my father taking off when I was 1 or 2 years old and never shown up had on me. And I said to myself that night, I'm not going to do this to my children. So how am I going to stay sober? So I come back to Dallas. They want me to stay, of course. You know, they got a net around me as we're leaving at the end of the week, and I feel trapped. And I'm not buying it. But I do go to an outpatient program at Timberlawn in Dallas, and Elizabeth and my daughter Rebecca, Alex is too young, and Debbie and I, and it's kind of a family deal. And outpatient, we went for 6 weeks. Still, nobody mentioned to me about AA. And I'm a lawyer, so I take a notepad. I'm going to take notes, which I did. I still have my notes. I'm going to take a test. I'm going to graduate, and everything's going to be all right. So we finished Timberlawn, and I go to my first AA meeting. It was a speaker meeting at Preston when the old Arthur Murray studio upstairs. And I listen to this speaker, and I look around at everybody in the room, and I look at all the little sayings on the wall, and I'm saying, I am not in the right place. Get me out of here. I go to my second AA meeting. Now, I'm still trying to say, you know, I know I'm going to stay sober, but I'm going to do this on my own. I've lived my life for 44 years on the basis of self-sufficiency. I was trained to see a problem, solve a problem, go on to the next problem. I go to my second AA meeting, and I meet Larry V. And here's this big lumbering guy in a blue exercise outfit, Nike exercise outfit, because that's all he had at the time. Those are the only clothes he had at the time. Big smile on his face. He said, "Hi, I'm Larry. I'm an alcoholic. How are you?" And he made me feel good. I'll never forget that. So I started going to AA meetings. And I started going to a lot of speaker meetings. I didn't relate to I went to discussion meetings, but I didn't like them. I didn't relate to them. I didn't understand what you guys were saying. I couldn't sound like you guys. You know, I wanted to talk like you guys were talking, but I didn't get it. But I went to the speaker meetings. And in August of 1998, my old buddy Jack Z was there at a speaker meeting. It was his first or second meeting. And we had drunk a lot of beer in college and hadn't seen each other for 20 years. But all of this was the beginning of a relationship of 20-plus years with these guys. And we still go to meetings today together when I'm in Dallas. We have a step study. Somebody asked me, you want to go to a step study? Sure. What are the steps? I went to that step study starting in 1989, and we still have that step study today. Jack started a big book study. And I still probably hadn't read the big book. I still go to meetings. And Jack was getting better than I was. I could tell. So I thought, maybe I ought to go to the big book study. And I did. And I love the big book. I was talking yesterday about the fact that I don't use maps. I buy complicated equipment. I do not read the direction because I kind of know what I need to do. With AA, it is the first time I've ever taken the directions and read them and tried to follow them. And they're all in the Kenny, the first 164 pages, I believe. You know, I got to... We got back from the meadows and we were to say that we were not getting along, Debbie and I, is a pretty gross understatement. So we signed up to go to this aftercare deal that another graduate of the meadows had been conducting. I went to individual therapy, group therapy, couples therapy, and I mean it was not working. One day she said, "Here's what you guys need to do to learn how to communicate. Debbie talks for 30 minutes, and you listen, and then you talk for 30 minutes, and she'll listen." And I looked at her, and I said, "What?" I don't know at what point in time. I went to the central group, the AA central group. That's where I finally settled, and... There was a guy there that I liked what he had to say, and I asked him to be my sponsor. Several months later, I said, maybe I need to work these steps. And we started down the process of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps. I don't have time I do have the steps written down here, and I could share them with you, but I don't have time tonight. unless y'all won't stay. But the only problem I had with, steps one and two, the only problem I had with step two was God. You know, I had grown up in the Episcopal Church. I had loved the Episcopal Church. I had spent a lot of time in college trying to figure out the answers about what God was all about. And then alcoholism started growing. And those hangovers on Sunday morning started getting worse. And I put church and God on the shelf. So I got here, and I looked in the wall, and I looked at those steps, and I looked at the word God, and I said, I can't do that. And only at the point in time when the pain got so severe for me, and my sponsor said, all you have to do is to be willing to believe. Why don't you just say some prayers? You don't have to believe in them. Just start saying them. And at that point in time, that crack in the door opened for me. And my spiritual experience began. It's taken a long time. Mine is the educational variety. I had no burning bushes, no sudden findings. But today, because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of the meetings I go to, and because of this conference, I have a relationship with the higher power of my understanding that gives me the peace and serenity that I didn't have, that I described when I was growing up and when I was in those early marriages, my early marriage and my second marriage. And it gives me the ability to listen to you all about being a parent and about being a husband. And, today, I forgot to mention one thing. In 1988, when I got here, Bonfire of the Vanities, I made a lot of money. I had this balance sheet that was this big with assets and this big with liabilities and zero cash. And the world ended. Real estate world ended. And we were broke. Bill Wilson talks about the paper millions, dealing in thousands and talking in paper millions, and those paper millions went away for us. And it was a very trying and tumultuous situation. And I tried to hold on to those things the first 3 or 4 years of sobriety, and I like to think that God took them all away from me so that I could realize that I didn't need them to be okay. So we started out in, about 1993 with, I had a job, good job, still a job. Hated my job, hated my law firm. But we had plenty of food on the table and always had a roof over our heads. And, but we were, we were negative. And, for a guy who put his entire self-worth in the fact of how many cars he had and how many houses he had and how much money he had, it was a humbling experience. So we started again. I hated my job. My law firm failed in 1994. I joined another big law firm. I hated that. 1996 or 97, because I could trust God, I took a chance and went out on my own. And I've never been happier. I've got a great law business. Today, I need to finish up, unless y'all want to stay. where we are today in our lives, and I need to mention two other things. My mother, the woman I never had a relationship with, she was an alcoholic. I couldn't call my mother, and we couldn't go over and see her after 5 o'clock, her last 15 or 20 years of her life. It was too painful. I mean, she drank scotch in those big iced tea glasses, and she only had one. But it was a sad situation, just, and it tore me up immensely. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, in her last years, I was able to be a son with some support, and I was able to go over and see her, even though it was painful for me to go over and see her, and to put her in a nursing home when it was appropriate, and to give her attention when I didn't want to. I mean, I never had an adult conversation with my mother. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to do the right thing with my mother. The other thing I want to mention is 6.5 years ago, I was not happy with my own relationship with Debbie and with my kids. And someone suggested I go to an Al-Anon. Debbie actually suggested that I'd go to Al-Anon. I started going to Al-Anon meetings. And I learned about detachment with love. And I learned about some of those sayings that we see on the wall. And I love to go to Al-Anon meetings today. I attend Al-Anon when I'm in Crested Butte. I don't do it in Dallas. But 5 years ago, our son decided to experiment with drugs and alcohol and got in a lot of trouble. And here we are, we're 15 years into sobriety and we have no clue what's going on. But because of Al-Anon and because of the support in these rooms, you know, we lived through that and he lived through that. And we learned how to parent him in here. And today, he's not an Alcoholics Anonymous. He thinks this is a cult. But he did tell me last night that two of his friends got kicked out of a bar and that there were two chairs waiting for his friends in here. So I'm not sure what that means, but he's sober. He's done fabulously well at Texas Tech. He's going to graduate in December. And we were able to live through that part of our lives and give him the help and support and direction and detachment that we would not have been able to do but for Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, Debbie and I are partners in life. I love her to death. We have a great life. We get to live here. We get to live in Dallas. We get to raise our children. Most of the time we're on the same page. Those financial burdens that, you know, the money, I got plenty of money in the bank. I get to live in the present today. I have a fabulous life, and I get to have this fabulous life as long as one day at a time I can maintain my conscious contact with God, attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and, you know, try to carry this message to other alcoholics. I got to read one. This is what you get. This is what I've gotten. I'm going to read one thing, and then I'm going to close. If I can find it. With all these papers. You know, it's just who I am. Isn't that right, Zach? You're supposed to just tell you who I am. My children think that I talk to them like a lawyer. Here it is. I got this message yesterday. It's from Elizabeth and Alex's sister, who can't be here tonight. She's lives in Austin, Texas, and she runs a dog hotel. In case you live in Austin, you need to take your dogs. You live in town. Taking to Rebecca's Austin Dog Town.
And daycare.
Hi, Daddy. I can't tell you how proud I am of you. That I can truly say that I'm who I am because of your strength and determination to become and stay sober. Your willingness to let yourself to be so vulnerable and to deal with your addiction on a daily basis continues to inspire me and make me want to be a better person. I'm so amazingly proud of you. The last few years have been definitely crazy for me. I've taken leaps I never would have thought of strong enough to take, but knowing your strength has definitely inspired me. Your support during the good, bad, and ugly has meant the world to me. I love you so much. I'm proud of you. I can't wait to continue to grow in our relationship and create more memories. I'll be there 100% in spirit tomorrow night. Can't wait to hear all about it. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has brought me. Thank you very much.